You're listening to episode 4 of the Hopkins Review podcast. This episode features Gloss for Fathers, a poem by Elizabeth Hazen. An interview with our fiction editor Danielle Evans, the author of The Office of Historical Corrections, and an excerpt from the story Cooler by Elise Levine.
Gloss for Fathers. Speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know? From Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays. What I mean to say is that all fathers bear the burden of their children's blame. Bedtime stories promised us protection, but gave no guidance about dangers we brought on ourselves. How could he save us from every whim to fight or steal or dull the edges with this shot, that pill? And yet our anger bubbled. We were disasters spitting at the brim, speaking indifferently to him to hide our hurt. Shall we catalog our grievances? Did one concern money, lack of attention, lack of love? Did we sense we were not good enough? Against the brick wall, he held me, eyes sharp with fear, in a chokehold to save me from my own flailing fury. His hand around my throat, more embrace than assault. My father, suddenly old, who had driven out the cold for me and taught me the physics required to move through time and space, had never held me with such force before. I'll take this as a kind of love. What I mean to say is, how can we know what circumstances may compel a man to act? For years, I'd been part of the audience, his presence like a poster. I ironed my best dress as under a spell and polished my good shoes as well for each performance, desperate to catch his eye. What I mean is, a person can feel two things at once, a doubled blade, not quite enough to cut us off completely. Trumpet in hand, his silence was not slight. He had to save his breath. His tuxedo, frayed cuffs, patched elbows, did not signify the choice I once believed. He played his part, show after show. What did I know? What did I know?
And now, an interview with Danielle Evans.
Hi, Danielle. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first, I wanted to ask you about the pieces you've worked on for the Hopkins Review, and what excited you about them.
It's been really great. I mean, one of the things, the delights of being fiction editor, is that I can both reach out to people and ask if they have something, and I can also reach out to people about specific stories. So one of the ways that I've been getting work with the Review is I often get sent very early copies of books before the galley, because the publisher would like me to blurb them. And so often when I'm reading that, I fall in love with the story and just menace the author and ask, you know, what's available? Can I have this one? And so it's worked out a couple of times. That's how we got Wahine Ibarra and Alejandro Varela's stories. I read their books and was just like, you know, I was in love with the pieces that we took, but there were also so many other stories. I just kind of wrote to them and said, like, here are the things I'm in love with. What can we have? And it's nice because, you know, when you get an early copy of the book, the author is also still often doing some line edits. And so we can still have an editorial conversation, but it is a pretty fully cooked piece. One of the other ways that I've been looking for work from the Review is reaching out to emerging writers. I know people who I know are looking for sometimes a debut publication or have had a couple of publications but are still widely submitting. So students I've taught at summer classes, students from previous institutions, And so that's another way that I've been looking for work. We have a couple of great stories that came through that coming in next semester.
Yeah, and that's been so appreciated. You're a very effective menace. We had Wahini Vara's short story, The Irates, on the previous episode. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what excited you about that one specifically.
Yeah, I think it just had such a compelling voice and also a really beautiful and complicated portrait of grief. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a sort of hard, it's actually really hard to write about grief because it's such a universal feeling that I think a lot of the things we want to say about grief feel either too manufactured or they feel cliche. And so when a story can really just kind of capture the sense of loss that that narrator is going through after her brother's death, but in a way that also feels wholly tied to this really original perspective, it can really sort of effectively convey the emotion. So I think that's what I was really captured by in that story.
Yeah, when the author captures a specific brand of grief, say like Wahini does so well, that's really exciting in fiction. What was your own experience with literary magazines?
Yeah, my very first publication was in Phoebe, which is the literary magazine out of George Mason. At that point, this was way back in the long ago and far away. We had to hike 7 miles up the mountain in the snow. Everything was mail. And so I think I didn't submit anything in graduate school, partly because I would get as far as printing the thing and I would lose my nerve between my house and the post office. So I think I put one thing in the mail to like a magazine that then immediately folded and I took it as a sign. Wow. And I hadn't submitted anything really since then. And so when I had a postgraduate fellowship and I thought we had free postage in the main office, all you had to do was like address the envelope and drop it in the box, which seemed like you didn't have to go buy stamps and go to the post office. So it eliminated one stage of talking myself out of things. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to start sending my work out. So I had sent the story from my first collection, Harvest, maybe a dozen magazines and gotten varying degrees of encouraging to neutral rejections. And then Phoebe wrote back and took it. And so that was my, and I think you cannot buy a copy of that magazine because my father bought like their entire print run of like, my father has like 50 copies of that magazine. But it was delightful to see my work in print.
You mentioned the market, and I was wondering what place you feel the literary magazine has in today's market and today's culture.
I mean, I hope a vibrant one. I think I love picking up a magazine because you don't know what you're going to expect. I mean, I love a story collection, but I feel like then you're getting a map of one person's brain, whereas like a literary magazine is like wandering through a funhouse. You sort of don't know what the next thing is, and you can sometimes discover people who you wouldn't have been drawn to necessarily on your own. But there's something about a sort of, it's this, the magazines ideally have a sensibility, but also have a lot of individual people curating them, so they can have a wide aesthetic. And yeah. I think that's a really good thing for, I mean, obviously, I think one of the main markets for a literary magazine is emerging writers, because both you're sort of reading who else is out there and also reading different ideas of kind of what a story can be. But I hope also that a literary magazine is something that people can pick up like on the train or in a waiting area or in the way that we sort of encounter unfamiliar material and just kind of settle into it for a little bit. You know, you can read the magazine very slowly. I think you can come in and out of it very easily. And so I like to sort of have one in my bag at all times to just sort of jump in and see like what strikes me this time. And I hope that we can sustain a culture where we have the space to have magazines that both celebrate established writers and launch new ones.
I'm going to read the opening from my story, Cooler, and the opening section is called Casino. I interview Friday afternoon, Saturday morning by the pants, those pleats, that crease, the wedge shoes with arch support, and a good thing, too. That night I clock miles over the blue and gold carpet, resting the dogs only in the marble-clad stalls of the ladies' restrooms, where I briefly lose the clanging slots, the high rollers' yips and groans. One of my new job's perks is that I never have to steal away to the basement and bless the employee can. I learn fast. No strolling or loitering when a player runs serious hot. Dan or Gustavo or Cynthia tips forefinger to brow, and I amble over to the big table and ask in. Don't let on that my chips belong to the house. Strike up an unassuming convo with the Rocketeer and dampen the sparks. Not that I'm cheating or distracting, it's my mere presence does the trick. Nothing crackles from me. My luck, failure to win. Killjoy, my parents taunted whenever the fam played crazy eights and I cried over my starter kitty of 10 pennies going and gone. Sad sack Samantha, mom and dad would jeer, world's sorest loser. By age 10, I knew that stoic resignation was my best, if not my only, bet. Until I met Deb and leveled up, got my awareness raised. My one and only old flame, she who trafficked in multidimensional, high-frequency attunements and how they flow, or don't, in my case. I miss her. She failed to tear my heart out, but it was complicated nonetheless. We met cute one rainy afternoon 2 weeks ago. I, assistant stockist at ShopSmart, 24 years of age, a newly barely degreed in business comm with a marketing concentration, and so with little hope of moving the dial on my fortune in the world, uncharacteristically threw caution to the wind and abandoned my post stacking gum and candy bars to help scan her Tafuti, a product new to me and the store, at the self-checkout. She was something in her purple tea dress and yellow flip-flops and crystal pendant necklace, and I don't know what came over me, some sudden notion I had to, for once, seize the day, carpe diem, ironically coming easily to mind, being my former high school's motto, but which pretty much had never pertained to me. When out of nowhere she pulled an eerie preempt by asking me out for matcha when my shift ended. Me, matcha. In no time we were at the cafe next door in the strip mall, a place I'd previously eyed but, frankly, had been too intimidated to try. And she was reaching across a wobbly cafe table to straighten my twisted polo collar and leaning close swear she could see my muddy aura spike pastel peach. A smidge, she said. Nothing razzle-dazzle. She liked to keep things real. That very evening we spooned on her couch. Spooned. And straight away it was all hard on me, not what I was used to. Winning for a change. It made my jaw ache, my feet itch. What's up? She asked, when I crawled onto her carpet and curled on my side. I spilled the uncool beans. She sat up straight with her arms folded and a frown on her face. Maybe slip into something more comfortable? With some coaxing, I shrugged off my shirt, and she disappeared into her bedroom and returned bearing a satiny bathrobe, freshly laundered, as she explained. I donned the garment, but I, who found it taxing to make it to my neighborhood soap opera quick wash once a week, immediately succumbed to the worst rash. A soothing shower? At her urging, try a new look for the new you. I ran her blow dryer to straighten my habitually tangled curls, and clumps dropped to the floor. Forget stoic. I moped. I cried. I lost sleep, downgraded to a measly 7 hours a night, and grumbled about my fatigue like an old coot. So much for new, I believe I moaned. And so, 3 more days into the cuddle doves, she announced her imminent departure on a major, never coming back from trip, which she kindly claimed she'd been planning to do for a while. Something about needing desert and red rock and star seeds and the alchemy of ascension to salve the damages of a lifetime of betrayals and poor sportness, the latter an attitude I apparently owned, wounds I'd at the very least neglected to fix. She told me this huddled over kombucha shots at the cafe I now, on this my second visit, pre my next shift at the store, considered our place while I studied the green gunk on the inside of my glass. Go ahead, she urged me in a tone so sweet my teeth hurt. Get your grump back on. She understood. No way would she take it personally. And did I know the local casino could use help like mine? Which, alas, she could not. Customers came and went, placing orders at the counter, hefting hips onto the stools by the window that looked out onto our mini mall's parking lot. Always motion, change, except I couldn't move. Could not. She took my hand, which felt like someone else's. On second thought, it felt like just mine, like how mine always felt, like it was embarrassed to belong to luckless me. She flashed a smile big on the gums, and I revived enough to tell her no worries, it was okay, I got it. Her smile sagged, and she sighed and said the rest would be her one way to Phoenix. Whereas you, and here her voice took on this whispery, seer-like tone that quivered the hair on my arms, you, sad sack Samantha, Wilmington born and bred, will forever stay. And so it was revealed. I at least had a gift I could cash in. Which led the stagnating shop smarter to get rear in gear and land this better paying, way more interesting gig. With my third paycheck, I bankroll more PermaPress. The months pile on, and the sensible shoes wear out, but I never mess with the style. What works, works. A year clicks over, and still thinking of Deb, the hippie drama with which she dressed, her free-spiritedness, I brave a splash-out. The blazes upgrade from cotton poly to lyocell, beige to pale pink and royal blue. Everything no iron, but no prints, no way. I hold my breath and keep my job. Further emboldened, I add in the aspirational knockoff purse, spring for clear polish on the nails, hair done a medium wavy bob that covers the bald patches from my unfortunate episode with Deb Stryer, then every 6 weeks a lob back to bob and so forth, with humble highlights kicked in. Not that anyone will notice, which is the point, that I fly under the cosmic vibe radar, which is tough. Herein lies my dilemma. It sucks that my job suits me like silk, that my modest good luck, being my kind of luck, might scram. Minutes to midnight on a royal blue Tuesday, I've just returned from bathroom bake, and there at the blackjack is something so far out I wonder if even Deb could have foreseen it. The auburn hair in a loose updo, fat onyx studs agleam in seashell ears, a gauzy red capelet floating about the shoulders of a black sheath. The silvery laugh at each blown hand and shivery hiccups upon tossing back each comped drink. At each fold, the clapping like a kid giddy on Kool-Aid, the bracelets circling her wrists offering a festive tambourine shake. She's down 3 grand, 5, 7. She's grand. Even Gustavo smiles. As per my job, I keep it cool. A crowd has gathered, but what's the deal? She's just another loser, just like me. Okay, maybe on a more exalted, next-level scale, a whale of a loser, but so? I keep it sour. How come she gets to live so large, when here I am, months into antacids for dinner, at my growing fear that each treasured worknight might be my last? Odds are things will go south. I can practically count on it. Worse, something to do with the whale, I think, near hypnotized by a certain pull on me, this tightening, lengthening, this perking in parts, including but not limited to my heart, and that I try my best to ignore, woefully aware of the little that's ever come of the experience, I find myself momentarily helpless to recount a representative sample of my lifelong chill pills. Deb's piled on pity, a karma kombucha, for one. For two, Franny Taggart's snort when, at age 12, trying to impress her, I split my lip from a botched twirl at the skating rink. For three, why not Danny Rogelman's fat chance piped at me in front of our tittering grade 9 French class after I slipped the note asking him to prom. Four, in college, Maya Chu's toothpastey what the when I nuzzled her ear at student union movie night. And Bergman's persona ever since reminding me of a 2-mile solo return walk through freezing sleet to our cinder block dorm. Do I know cold? And while I break my heart again for each old time's sake, the whale burns wads with such joy, a damp I'm okay, not okay fire swamps my bones. At 5 in the morning, she finally packs it in. just as I bet she would, lays upon the dealer one lit tip. For days I hardly sleep. At nights she's a no-show until Tuesday rolls around again, and blessedly still on the job, I'm witness to another whale of a show and the crowd she draws. I survey her table from afar until I can't take it any longer. Her air of victory at each triumphant loss, the brutal thrill that now streaks through me, and go warm a seat in one of the fancy bathrooms, checking off-brand sales on my phone while randos shuffle in and out of the surrounding stalls, which kills me. I have all the feels and all the questions, but such is life when the whys and hows are not for pity parties like me. The end of my shift finally draws nigh. Figuring the coast might be clear on the floor, the crowds hushed back to their homes, I flush and open. There she is, exiting the stall next door. We stop short and stare. Is she tall? Gangly arms and legs poke out of a swingy, swirly color number. Pretty sure I'm now gawking. From this close up, I realize she's too damned thin. As if, despite her elan, her writ largeness with the big flop, because of the cost such brio exacts, something super wrong. I think warm plates of box mac and cheese, steaming bowls of instant ramen, dishes I can actually sort of cook. I think of Deb, offering a split-second prayer of gratitude for her role in leading me to this moment, an instant in which I'm also aware I might never think of Deb again. As if the whale can read my thoughts, she flirt tilts her chin. Heat rises in my throat and face, not entirely pleasant. Okay, somewhat pleasant. Very confusing. What, me blush? She raises a bony finger to her lips. Between us, she says. I clock out at 7 in the morning, and by 7:30, we're holding hands in the front seat of her Fit, having made out, sort of, given the size of her car. Something unfamiliar bubbles in my gut. What am I? What is she? We? Happy as candy, she says, withdrawing her hand to offer a breath mint. We chew and suck in silence, and then she starts the car and pilots us out of the underground lot, leaving my ancient centrist fate to the mercy of the towing gods, who usually can't resist harshing those of my ilk. But I'm all what? Me worry now? 20 minutes later, she pulls over in front of my apartment building, and I ask her in. She leans over and kisses me once more. My chest thrums, my head between my legs. She is a mystery at heart, and so am I. And it's cool. And maybe I'm cool. First time for everything. Until a freak niggle hooks me. A tiny, insistent worm, and, dum-dum that I am, I bite. Where's it all coming from, I ask. The money is what I'm thinking, blundering past my churning thoughts of sex, power, powerful sex, me and her forever, blindly thinking more in this moment in accordance with the tedious precepts of my schooling, of how to make the stone-coldest buy-in of my life. She withdraws into her seat and faces forward. Yeah, she says, just some clients. I should have known. As if I could press my luck, as if I had her buckets to spend. Now I can count on the big N-O to my as-yet-unasked question, the one about coming inside, never mind my studio sublets, a hazmat zone, the big ask with the oversized subtext, care to join me in fanning what might could turn into an eternal flame? And yet my yearning soul remains split. Clients, the word orbits my brain. How do you find these dopes? I blurt, figuring I've blown it with her anyway and now have nothing left to lose. She studies me a long moment. A wavelet of excitement laps my throat. I gulp it in and, greedy for more, hold her gaze. Oh ho, she says evenly. Easy, tiger, not so fast. I do it anyway. Desperate now, in full recognition of my initial breach, I rewind, I show her fast. I'm sorry, my mistake, I get it, and when can I see her again? Movie date, bistro dinner, sunset stroll along the pinkening beach, shelter for two under a single blanket while the horseshoe crabs mate under the full moon. No, No, shared snoot of gin from a flask during my break next Tuesday at the casino. Side-by-side swings on the swings in a park in her neighborhood? Where did she say she lived? She hisses a cold breath, reaches across to open my door, arm grazing my breasts. I gasp, arch my back. Okay, yes, I could go again. Why not? But she withdraws her arm and nudges my shoulder hard with hers. I shrink in my seat. Okay, I say. I get it. Really, I do. Though I don't, not any of it. Not me and her. Not the apparent business she's apparently in. But okay, okay, okay. No argument from me. She tootles off. I stand as if glued to the sidewalk. And then, within half a block, she hits the brakes and reverses with a squeal. Behind me, a car horn honks, someone heading the right way along the one way. The driver shakes a fist. The whale, my first, my only whale, swerves even with me and buzzes down the window on my side while the car behind us wails. I lean in. Gray eyes, somehow elegant pimple to the left of her off-center, regal nose. I wonder when she'd found time to reapply her red lipstick, the exact shade I notice now as her cape. Her lips part once more, and my breath catches like some creature, some hitherto hidden something, a thing I can't possibly know what, shocked to suddenly surface mid-air. "We're something," she says, as if she sort of kind of read my mind. "Really something." I snap the blackout curtains shut, take off my pants and shoes and blouse. Unusual for me, hang what needs hanging and line up what needs lining. And then pace in circles, a strange fizz in my fingertips, my knees, my tongue where it fished hers. Clients, something. My brain burns between you and me, like we share a secret, or we're the secret. And who would I tell? Tell what? I lie on the bed. It spins, or I do, like a roulette wheel. I can't help the cringy thought, twirling for all the little I'm worth as her red cape flutters in my dazed head. I press my own finger to my own lips. Somehow, they're spinning too. Also, for all the little I'm worth. Or is it, might it be, the more? 2 weeks drudge by, no whale. Such is my life, and such will it ever be. My upsides, my downsides. Still, I order a half dozen shrink-wrapped 20 packs of breath mints online, next day delivery, and chew and suck as if they might return her. 2 more weeks pass, then 2 more. And then 2 by 2 they come, until a year and then another sails past. I buy more same old pants and blouses and shoes. But, and, I make a habit of hanging my things in the closet and aligning the condiment bottles on the fridge shelves. And it all looks pretty good, everything in its place. That third winter, my hair grows out enough to entirely cover my bald patches, the ones from when I tried the blow dryer in so-and-so's bathroom. I realize this sounds cruel, but who even was that anyway? And though once again, I go about my days and nights slow and steady, like I'm walking on eggshells, now it all feels like something, an accumulation of somethings that together might could make a larger something, a thing that can't be rushed. Until spring returns and I say duck it, purchase a slim-fit shirt with scarlet pinstripes, scarlet, and hold my breath as spring roars to summer, and defying fate, live to tell the tale, tuck a sturdy grin beneath my professional, placid mien. Job neatly done, that's my style. Work or home, risk believing I've at last found my spot in the lottery of longings. A new year begins. At the casino, the flyers fly up, up and away on successive hands, the air thinning until they're north of nowhere anyone should ever be, in grave danger of losing themselves in the quivering frequencies of pure light. And it's okay. I've got them. I, their minty-breathed friend in time of need, lift too, swanning through the graces of my lucklessness by virtue of my mere proximity at the gaming tables, my lo-fi vibe enough to fish them back to a place not too hot, not too cold. Like me, just right. Things look up in other ways, too. Don't ask me how. I'm a newcomer to this special game. But my best bet is word of mouth, insider knowledge passed along. And also don't inquire about the long-term cost-benefit, keeping in mind the possible personal price my now lost-to-me whale paid. And for sure, don't wonder aloud where the blazes she went to in the end, if it was a case of she got out of the racket altogether or found fairer seas elsewhere. But anyway, whatever the reasons and whatever the qualms, what's not to be beat is I'm needed and appreciated here. Last night alone, on three separate occasions, players slipped me their business cards. Handwritten on their backs in tiny lettering, a certain now trending plea. Call, the clients in waiting implore. Name your price. Save us, please.
Thank you for listening to the Hopkins Review Podcast, Episode 4. The poem Gloss for Fathers was written by Elizabeth Hazen and read by the author. Elizabeth Hazen is a poet and essayist. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Best American Poetry, Epoch, American Literary Review, Shenandoah, Southwest Review, and other journals. She has published two collections of poetry, Chaos Theories in 2016 and Girls Like Us in 2020. She lives in Baltimore with her family. The story Cooler was written by Elise Levine, and the excerpt from it was read by the author. Elise Levine is the author most recently of Say This, two novellas, as well as two story collections and two novels. Her work has also appeared in Plowshares, Blackbird, The Gettysburg Review, and Best Canadian Stories. She teaches in the MA in the writing program at Johns Hopkins University. Both the poem and the full story are featured in the Hopkins Review issue 16.4. Danielle Evans is the author of the story collections, The Office of Historical Corrections, and Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. She is the 2021 winner of the New Literary Project Joyce Carol Oates Prize, a 2020 National Endowment for the Arts Fellow, and four of her stories have been anthologized in the Best American Short Stories. She teaches at Johns Hopkins University. She is the fiction editor of the Hopkins Review. Our theme music was written by Jameson Owens and performed by Jameson Owens and Landon Razick. I'm Gabriel Da Silva-Skiki, managing editor of the Hopkins Review, which is a partnership between the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins University and the Johns Hopkins University Press. Special thanks to editorial assistant Sophia Berkey.